Did you know that oat milk uses a lot less water, less land, and creates far less greenhouse gases than cow's milk? This useful fact is brought to you by Oatly, the vegan oat milk originally from Sweden that's now available in the U.S. You can find out more useful facts than you'd ever want to know about oat milk at oatly.com. That's OATLY.com. I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Mike Messersmith, General Manager for Oatly. Mike leads all aspects of U.S. operations, innovation, business strategy, sales hiring, and finance for Oatly. He's basically like 10 episodes of In the Sauce in one guest. I'm going to try. I know sometimes
it's a megapod.
I mean, this is like a super pod. Also, yeah. One note is I've been trying to get Mike on this show for like since we started. So you will notice that they are our sponsor now, but it has nothing to do with Mike's being.
I can double stamp that. Nothing to do at all.
You didn't pay me.
We've been talking about this for a while. I'm glad the schedules finally made it work.
So the thing about you is like, I don't know, just as a personal little story, you know, my son was a little unsure about what he wanted to do in college, and I called you, and you spent hours with him. You're one of those guys. You're so humble. You're such a good guy. You answer every question. You're building this, like, mega thing, and you just always have time for the people in your life, I guess, that you care about. And I'm just really psyched that I somehow
that's so kind
slipped into that.
No,
bucket.
I love it. That's, I mean, ultimately, we're in a relational business, yeah. And like those connections are a big part of why I'm in the job or any success I've had is not partial. I mean, it's not really due to me, it's the team and the relational pieces around me, and so.
It's also a killer product, which
it's a great
we will
product.
Get to.
It's phenomenal.
But since now I know that you've listened to a few episodes now, we're going to get into you a little bit. You grew up in Pennsylvania.
I did.
You traveled around a lot because your dad had a job which required traveling a lot, or he kept moving to places. What were you like? Were you as gregarious as you are now? Were you quiet? Were you?
I definitely wasn't quiet. My dad switched jobs a bunch when I was growing up. I switched schools a bunch when I was growing up. And so when you're like short and a bit like stocky would be the way that like I think JCPenney's would say it on my jeans, husky.
Yeah, husky is the word I was
And you're switching
for.
Schools. Yeah. You need to be like you compensate with humor and relational pieces. And so like I would get to a new school and make friends. Like,
hey, I'm Mike.
I'm Mike. I know baseball statistics and things like that. And so I was not a wallflower. Always pretty much a outgoing, pretty gregarious.
Did
person.
You get in trouble?
No, I was terrified of getting in trouble. Yeah. I was a strict rule follower for many, many years. My wife now is a habitual rule breaker, and that just makes me like it makes me super uncomfortable. I struggle with getting in trouble and living in fear of that. Yeah.
I mean, because I can kind of see you like being in like the scrappy group of kids that does get into trouble, but you're always like out the door.
That's exactly
fast.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm
you
actually going to a
caught.
High school reunion this weekend, and I'm going to see some of those people that were doing like the bad things in high school and middle school. And I was like the one that they told their parents that they were going out with.
Yeah.
So that it was all like approved that we would get to go. Like, well, Mike's going. And they're like, oh, we trust Mike.
That's
and then like,
funny.
I don't know, I would just drive home or something.
Yeah, I can totally picture that. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. So do you remember what you wanted to be?
So I didn't remember what I wanted to be when I grew up until in my research and my prep for this megapod, I like knew that it was coming up and I had to have a good answer. So I asked my mom if she remembered, and she and my dad conferred that the thing I wanted to be was to be a food critic.
Oh my gosh.
Which
that's kind of perfect.
I guess. I really like to eat.
Yeah.
So there's that. I like to talk about things.
Yeah.
So there's another piece. We lived in Connecticut for a while when I was a child, and I had a whole rating systems for New England clam chowders in the greater New England, like Mystic area, which is way too much information.
No, I think it's awesome. But my big question is, like, why did you block that from your memory?
I don't know. I think I suppressed it. I don't
know.
That's
so crazy.
But yeah, I mean, eating food and having an opinion is like, there's never been a better time to be alive.
By the way, I'm surprised I didn't want to be a food critic.
You'd be a great
I really would have been a good food critic. I don't know that there would have been much, you know, work for me.
And then you just watch enough episodes of Top Chef and you're able to say it's like, it's well balanced.
Right. Good mouthfeel.
Could use a little bit more acidity. A little bit under seasoned for me. The risotto is terrible.
I like the mouthfeel and toothsome.
Oh, toothsome is a good one. Like the pasta was a bit toothsome. It's a great word.
So when you went to, Duke.
I did.
You know, this podcast has a weird disproportionate number of Duke graduates, including myself. And I don't consider myself like a particularly like Blue Devil-ish. I don't actively seek out people.
No face paint? Like there's no face paint or conquest?
No, I don't even know when basketball is happening. And that's fine. I haven't been back.
I'll send you an email.
Okay, great. But you went to Duke.
I did.
And you did Naval ROTC.
I did.
So did you want to be in the Navy or was that your way of getting...
It was a little bit of both. So I wanted to go to a great school. Yeah. I've always had an element of trying to be a little bit self-determining and autonomous. And there's a great program where the government will, I honestly would have never cut it at a service academy. I was not cut out for the Naval Academy. While I do following rules, it would have been too strict for me. Yeah. So you get the best of both worlds of getting to go to both an awesome private school with a great basketball team, sports teams, like fraternities, all that stuff.
Right.
And the government pays for your full tuition.
As long as you do
You do, you have to, an obligation after you graduate, which I didn't realize at the time, but was kind of awesome because I didn't have to worry about internships and new jobs.
Right.
And like I had a job already when I graduated, which allowed me to pick majors and take classes that I wouldn't have necessarily, all my friends that were doing like econ and public policy majors and working really hard to get internships. Like I didn't do that.
Did you have to be like an engineer STEM guy?
They really wanted you to be engineer STEM guys, but I was a history and elementary education major.
That's so cool.
Because I'm good at reading books.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing.
Yeah, and you know, the military needs like some historians and some readers and some analytics.
And,
you
like, know, not being just able to think critically on stuff. And as it turned out, I ended up doing engineering things in the Navy anyway. Because
You can do both. That. Because that's what makes you a generalist.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Like left brain, right brain stuff. Yeah. So it was a great program because I was able to pay for college and take that burden off of my parents, go to a great school that I was super proud of. Great 4 years, North Carolina. Good times.
So then you did 4 years of service and then you went to business school.
I did.
Why?
Yeah. So like I loved my time in the Navy. That was, I spent 5 years on active duty as an officer in the Navy in the nuclear power program for them on aircraft carriers, which have nuclear reactors on board. And it's a very different day-to-day life than selling oat milk for a living.
Mm-hmm.
But
we'll get to some parallels.
There's some parallels there that help me. And I love my time. And honestly, like I knew that I was around people that I liked and respected, but I saw what you're away from your family, you're away from the people that are really like your people in life for so long. And it's I moved 5 times in 5 years and it was hard to really establish roots. I didn't want to do that for the long term. I was very proud of the chapter that I had.
Yeah.
Father was in the Navy. Both my grandparents were in the military during World War II. So it was a great legacy of service within my family that I was proud to be a part of. But I didn't want to do that long term. I didn't have an ambition of being a sea captain for a living. That didn't really blow my hair back. And then for business school, like I saw people getting out, and a lot of them were going to very like lateral sort of like very technical jobs.
Right.
And that wasn't I wanted something that was a balance of technical analytical ability and relational ability, which is the thing I think I do really well, is build great relationships and communicate on things. And so business school was kind of that launch pad pivot for me of going from a very, it was a great career switching moment. I tried to use business school for what it's really good for, which is to help you make a pivot from one thing to another in your career.
Because you didn't know what that, you didn't know what you just,
I wrote my essay about like wanting to bring nuclear power solutions to America. And I honestly thought I'd work at like a big industrial firm.
Right.
And then I talked to more people at school and they were like, no, like a consumer package. I had a friend that worked at a consumer packaged goods company and she described her job. And I was like,
that's cool.
That's awesome. Because you get to like own a product, make decisions. Like you're using data to inform data and like information to inform like calls you have to make. I was like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, it's interesting because we had, I had another guest on who is now, she does VC. It's Lauren Jupiter. And she went to, Dove Soap during business school. It was like one of her sort of internships. Yeah. And it was like the first time she ever sort of saw behind the curtain that there are all of these decisions, like the thing that you're using to wash your face or that you're pouring in your coffee. Like there's a whole slew of stuff going on behind there that informs those decisions and how to make the package and what goes into it, how they communicate, all of that stuff. And if you kind of get into it, I don't think there's anything I've ever
100%
studied that's
more
fun. And
like being a part of a company that makes an accessible product that regular people can enjoy, that you don't have to shop at a fancy place to be able to buy, or that, you know, I think about where I grew up in Northeast Pennsylvania that like, you know, would have been something that would have been in our fridge. Like that piece is motive. I would not be suited for luxury goods. Or like it's just not me. And so, it's not. But like accessible, like mass, like accessible products is, that's a great space to be in because you can actually add value to people's lives.
So you went straight from business school to Frito-Lay?
I did. Yeah.
And was that just like they go to Harvard and they're like, hey, Harvard, send us some...
Something like that. It was, I thought I wanted
like
to work
how in... I slipped the Harvard Business School in there.
I did see that. Yeah. I wasn't going to, it was,
I know, yeah, I know.
It's the school in Boston.
Cause you're a humble guy in Cambridge.
Yeah. In Cambridge, school in Cambridge. But I thought I wanted to work in consumer packaged goods and I applied for every internship that you could imagine. And there were a handful of them on campus. It was like a little bit of a different time with how people thought about jobs and shaping their future. And I got rejected for every single one of the interviews.
Really?
Trying to convince like CPG marketers that like this Navy
guy,
engineering officer who has no experience could like do this job was really, really hard. There was a team of people that came from Frito that were willing to like believe that I could do it.
Right.
And they gave me an internship and I am eternally grateful for that. I worked my butt
off.
It would
be hard to imagine. And I guess the thing is what you said is they didn't even give you an interview because once you got the interview, I'm sure anyone would hire you for anything. It was probably on paper.
I hope so. But it's when people are, I'm guilty of this even today when we hire, like it's hard sometimes to imagine, like you have a very set framework for how you're evaluating the candidate you want. You want to see certain types of companies, experiences, et cetera.
Right.
And like how you can read a cover letter, you might get like a call, you do an informational interview, but like it's hard to believe that some people can make that transition. So I don't hold it against those people. I just know that I was like going through it and was like, okay, I have like one left. Like, hope this works out. If not, I'm going to go do something else this summer.
So what did you do when you got to Frito-Lay?
So Frito was great. I had an amazing experience there. My wife and I lived in Dallas, Texas we're both like Northeast.
So you were married before business school?
We got married in the 2 weeks, right as I was graduating from business school. We dated entire time I was in business school. We got married right before graduation. I felt like before we moved to Texas, we needed to get married.
Yes.
That was a key part, both for her parents and just, I think, the law down there. we had like a 3-year adventure in Texas, which for both like Yankee liberals, like was, our like living abroad experience, but we made some great friends. I loved my time at Frito, like amazingly smart, dedicated people, great brands. I learned so much. And I think was a great stepping stone for other things. And also like, I talk to people now that are coming out of business school and they want to work in natural foods. And like, if I had done a job and I have friends that started their own companies right out of business school, work like that's great yeah. for them. And I'm super impressed by that. I think I would have been terrible at that.
Yeah.
Like I did not have the confidence and I needed more seasoning, I think, to like go to a place where there's structure and like big companies, like you can mess some stuff up, but you're not going to run it off the rails right. at that level and all those things.
Right.
And so, I learned a ton usually by messing things up, I think, at Frito. And like, that was a very valuable experience for me just to build some more professional confidence and momentum right. just in my career, I think.
Were you able to sort of like winnow down to like what was interesting about CPG at Frito? Like, was it a place where you were like, oh, okay, I'm going to be better at this than
yeah.
this? Or,
yeah.
Like,
I mean,
what'd you come up with?
I mean, I think like commercial and marketing roles of like how to move the market with distributors and customers, you know, how to build great communications frameworks. I mean, I was a brand manager on Doritos for which again is a pretty like nuclear power to Doritos brand management to Oatly are like a right. very wide spectrum of things. But Doritos, like your inner 17-year-old just rejoices every day of that brand. You're like doing activations with Snoop Dogg and like Xbox and things like that. It's amazing. But I think I took a lot of really positive things that helped me. I think I also saw some things about where food was moving and my own motivations of like, you're given this time on this earth and you're, you know, endowed with certain gifts and talents. And like, I really enjoyed that company, but I didn't want to necessarily sell
Doritos.
500 million pounds of nacho cheese Doritos like
yeah.
that. I felt like maybe there was a different application of that. And
right.
again, it's not a judgment of someone that wants to do those sorts of roles. Like they're great products that people enjoy that bring
yep.
genuine like joy and connection to people's lives. But it just, I got to see a little bit also of like the way big companies are structured, how they're competing in the market that I think also shaped then my goal after a couple of years of saying, okay, I want to now start to do stuff that's smaller,
right.
maybe a little bit more mission and values. And I've kind of now just continued to progress down that trajectory of my career.
And that's how you ended up at Chobani.
It is.
So what did you do at Chobani? And what was the shift? Like, what did you... You took your lessons from Frito-Lay and
yeah.
then you moved on to the next thing. And
yeah, I joined Chobani at a time of...
they weren't this big.
They weren't, no.
Yeah.
Well, they're not as big as... Yeah, I mean, they're an amazing company and
yeah.
they built something phenomenal, not as big as they are today, kind of in the middle. It's like the end of the beginning, I
right.
think, of that chapter, like
right.
where the company was definitely going through some transformations of people that had been there at the very beginning chapter.
Right.
Now upgrading into like kind of a middle transitionary
yep.
one, was colleagues with some of your other former guests.
I know, which is so funny.
Yeah. It was just like great, smart people. So I was initially in charge of all the shopper marketing of like working with customers on bridging like innovation and brand goals.
Can you just define shopper marketing
sure.
for our listeners?
So shopper marketing is an idea that companies have where you like, how do you channel your brand positioning and voice through your customers? So that could be part of it is like innovation strategy of getting them to be excited about the way you're approaching insights, category building. Some of it also can be like tactical tools like little pieces of paper you put on the shelf that
mm-hmm.
make people want to buy your product or couponing strategy. And so we didn't have that at Chobani before. I was hired to come in and try to create that because they felt they were getting a lot of pressure from retail customers, like, okay, you're pretty big now. Like, we now need to see
right.
things kind of go to the next level. We want to see you guys do these sorts of things. And so get a chance to build that. I ended up also running all of their field marketing and sampling and their showmobiles. I got a chance to do all the media strategy and planning for a while.
Wow, that's
before
a
I
lot.
Left. Yeah, but at a small company, you end up taking on different pieces yeah. as you grow and
yes.
kind of show that you're capable. And got to be a part of that journey through lots of amazingly smart people coming
yeah.
to the team. And those are some of the connections and relationships that, I mean, 15, 20 years from now, like people that were there during that time are going to be, are currently and will be doing
yep.
ridiculously amazing things.
Awesome.
It's so cool.
And then you left there. There was one more stop before
yes.
Oatly.
Yes.
So where'd you go?
Okay.
What'd you do?
So I worked at a company called the Nature's Bounty Company, which does vitamins and like protein bars and things. I'm not like a big power lifter person, but like I ran their sports nutrition portfolio. Now, that may seem like a really odd choice. It was out on Long Island. I took the train every day.
Yeah.
Very different company than Chobani. But for me, my time at Chobani really crystallized my belief that I wanted to go to something that was even earlier than where Chobani was. Right. I needed to go smaller.
You kept going smaller and smaller and smaller.
And I at that point knew I don't want to just be like a chief marketing officer. Like I want to, I think I can be and have the ability to be like a president, general manager type role. However, one of the limitations that you have in kind of the traditional marketing career path that I came out of is they don't ever really give you like the full financial responsibility right. of the businesses. They say, spend this money, but we'll tell you how much you get and right. like, do it toward these goals. And that doesn't mean you don't, you're not smart about how businesses work, but you're also not really accountable
right.
for all the pieces from forecasting to obsolescence to operations and
yep.
the kind of the full P&L management, profit yep. and loss statement management.
Mm-hmm.
And so my time at Nature's Bounty Company, I oversaw four portfolio brands. Some of them were big, some of them were small, some of them were growing, some of them were declining. and my job, like I owned the full financial accountability right. of that within that business unit. And so
you kind of ran those
yes.
brands.
Yes. And you know, the marketing, the sales strategy, right. like integration of the operations plan, like, and that for me, I viewed it as, there were good people that worked there. It was a good opportunity to get the things I felt like I needed right. to have in order to be a credible candidate for me to go to an investor, go to a founder and tell them that they should trust me
yeah.
with like running their business. I would have felt like if I hadn't had that experience and things didn't go perfectly at Nature's Bounty Company, those are hard brands, right. it's an incredibly competitive category.
But I mean, it rounded you out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I needed to have that to be credible and not both feel and in actuality be a fraud in saying that I was like ready to be given that opportunity.
So you knew you wanted to be a general manager of
yeah.
a brand. Like you yeah. knew that.
I mean,
can you just define that? Because
sure.
it is kind of
yeah, like general managers are like also sometimes like they run like convenience stores or like
no,
restaurants.
There's a GM, right.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
but we, I mean, Oli's a European company. They have different kind of like title structures on things. Mm-hmm. And so
what would it be in America?
I think it could be called like a president or something
okay.
like that.
Right.
Or like a business unit president, maybe.
Right.
But I wouldn't, it doesn't matter to me. The general manager, like I'm in charge of all aspects of the business and the brand. So, at the beginning when it was a mighty team of like three of us,
mm-hmm.
That is quite an empire of things, but you're in charge. I mean, commercial communications, operations, tying it all together with finance, organizational development, the
right.
strategy, all those pieces I've been able, you know, been incredibly fortunate to have a chance to kind of put my fingers on for Oatly here in the U.S.
Amazing. Okay, we're going to take a little break. When we get back, we're going to talk about the story of Oatly. We're going to talk about everything that I need to ask you. and you're going to share everything you've ever learned from any of your jobs
yes.
with everyone 100%, listening.
All of it.
Great. We'll be right yeah. back. In the Sauce is brought to you by Oatly, the vegan plant-based oat milk originally from Sweden that's now making their oat milk on this side of the Atlantic. I know you're used to hearing me talk about how important it is to have a killer product and a great brand identity, and Oatly has both. They're an oat milk company from the south of Sweden that's been around for 30 years making super sustainable oat milk. Actually, Oatly invented oat milk. Now they're in the US and people are loving it. If you haven't tried Oatly, I highly suggest it. It won't change your life, but it will certainly change your mornings. You can check it out at oatly.com. That's OATLY.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Katie Kiefer, and I'm the host of What Doesn't Kill You here on HRN. Every week, I sit down with journalists, authors, scientists, or activists to identify and explain some of the key issues in our food system. I've done shows on food waste, labor issues, meat production, water, you name it, I cover it. You can find What Doesn't Kill You wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm back with Mike Messersmith, General Manager of Oatly. Okay, so I think first of all, I don't know that a lot of people know that Oatly has been around for a while.
Yeah.
I think they think it's like a brand new thing and some dudes figured out how to make oat milk or something.
Yeah.
But can you like really quickly tell mm-hmm. the story of Oatly, A, and B, how they found you and how you found them and how the whole thing came to be.
Yep. So Oatly origin story, our founder, Dr. Rickard Oste, was a part of an academic team at a university in Sweden. They were part of the early team studying the effects of lactose intolerance on human populations, which is it doesn't affect kind of Anglo-European populations as prevalently, like is a global issue. And he, in a very classic Swedish fashion in the early 90s, was able to bridge that nutritional, dietary issue into the effects of that dairy industry on global warming and climate change. Mm-hmm. And he kind of set about to say, well, if half the world's population has lactose sensitivity issues and the dairy industry and the food and beverage industry as a whole is a huge contributor towards global warming and the effects of climate change, could we do it differently? If we had to start over again, how would I do it? And kind of searched out different source ingredients, looked at legumes, looked at nuts, looked at oats. It was really where it landed because oats are an abundant crop in Sweden. They have good inherent nutritional value. They're easy to grow. And they are very, they're not as taxing on our natural resources. And so he then, in addition to that academic research, created a manufacturing process to liquefy those raw oat kernels
and turn them into oat milk and it just congeals.
I know.
That was always the issue.
Yeah, Google makes it seem like it should be easier
it's
than
so
it is.
It's not easy.
That's part of the magic.
Yeah.
We have this oat-based manufacturing process where we take raw oat kernels that are stored in silos that come in on rail cars, and we break them down into a liquid oat ingredient format that is legitimately our secret sauce.
Yep.
And in Sweden, since the 90s, we've been turning that into oat milk, but also frozen treats.
Yeah. There are 80 products or something like that,
right? Yeah, it's 100 items.
Yeah.
And the mindset is for us, if the product was set out to give more delicious, nutritious elements that don't tax our natural resources, if we were a cow's milk company, what would we make?
Right.
And as it turns out, we can make almost all of those items using oats.
Yeah.
And oats are easy to grow. They're abundant in sourcing. And so that's been the goal.
And then when did they decide to come to the U.S.?
Yep. So in 2015, the company was kind of making a decision as we were bringing on some new investors of do we want to be this primarily Nordic-based company where we're having great success, but to go to kind of the next level, is this an idea that's transferable? Is oat milk something? I mean, at that point, no one in the United States was really drinking oat milk. There was some brands that were making it, but it hadn't really gained broad market traction at all.
No, we were still drinking soy at that point.
Yeah,
that was almond milk. I know.
Time machine,
remember
the DeLorean.
When?
Yeah. So the 2015, they're do we want to be this, do we want to stay on the Nordic focus or do we want to expand into other markets? And so at that point, Oatly made the choice. And what it's incredibly cool because it's the same product everywhere we are. It's the same brand. We use the same type of packaging.
Yeah.
Europe, United States, China. We embarked upon that journey starting really in 2015 of expanding to other markets in Europe.
Yep.
Germany, Austria, expanded presence in the UK, Nordics, China, and the United States. And so in late 2016, I started talking to them about the opportunity to come on board and kind of lead our U.S. market, which in that point was an incredibly nascent early stages.
Well, because when I think about it, you had to not only bring the brand to the United States, but you had to bring the whole category
it's hard building a business.
Yeah.
In an existing category.
Right.
But why does anyone need oat milk? And that was actually my initial reaction when they told me about it. Was I don't think that will work.
Did you really? You
yeah,
didn't think it would work?
100%. Well, no, I mean, on its face, I was it's over. Almond milk, it's a massive category.
Right.
I don't doubt that people are going to drink more plant-based products, but almond milk owns 75% of this category.
But the thing is, if you know how much water almond milk uses, just from the environmental perspective alone, when I first saw Oatly,
yeah,
I
I was there.
I mean, I was this is amazing because there are a lot of products that candidly, I don't think need to exist.
But there's not a lot. I mean, you'd also be in like classic brand management stuff. You wouldn't necessarily believe that people are going to make altruistic decisions with their pocketbook right. or their dollar based upon purely sustainability. Right. Now that's changing.
Right. It also happens to taste amazing.
It also has to work and taste yeah. great.
So when you agreed to come on board despite
yes.
not being sure.
Well, I was work. By the time I joined, I was completely sold. I tried trying the product
yeah.
and like seeing the ingredients, seeing the certifications, yeah. like the brand, like the portfolio of innovation we yeah. have, like all of that. I was like, okay, this is a winner. Like we
it's
can.
It's just such a perfect. It was like a perfect alignment for you
yeah.
and your experience, but basically. I mean, these guys were Swedish.
Yes.
My guess is that the markets look very different.
Yeah.
My guess is that people shop differently and stores operate somewhat differently and everything was different. So did you kind of come up with like, okay, here's how we're going to launch this thing. We're not going to try to get it on the shelves of Whole Foods first. We're going to get it into like the most amazing coffee shops and get people like addicted to it.
Yeah. I mean, we had through the process of me joining the company, even before I started, we had amazing, our CEO, Tony, creative director, John, like other people on the team. And I had great talks about how we would do this.
Right.
And our Swedish executive team and our Swedish team, Oatly team in general, like incredibly open to there's a lot of level of knowledge they bring, but they're also first to say that they're not the experts on what
the American
consumer, market is.
Right.
And so that's part of the reason if they thought that they were, and they might be right or wrong, that they wouldn't need me.
Right.
And they could just direct it from over there. But the reason they wanted to build a team over here was
right.
because they needed that level of expertise. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pieces of, you know, the bulk of the category and our sales in Europe are all in aseptic shelf-stable cartons.
Right.
There isn't a giant refrigerated section in grocery in Sweden. People
right.
are buying, eggs just non-refrigerated.
Right.
And even cow's milk is
yeah.
sold in aseptic packages
yeah.
there. And so we had to, and I think a key part for us, which even just, required recalibrating our forecast, talking to our investors about like what to expect from us at
mm-hmm.
the beginning in the United States was to say, we are not going to try to do retail until we feel like we're ready.
Right.
Like we are going to try to think creatively about our commercial strategy and our channel strategy. And let's try to do one thing really, really well. And that was not just like an idea that we had, like we had had success in Europe in specialty coffee shops, and we had like this great barista edition product. And we
mm-hmm.
said, let's try to do that part really well. And if that part works, it should, in theory, open the door for the rest and solve other just general brand building, company launching problems that we have.
I mean, did you just make that up out of your head? I mean, because if you think about it, like I can tell you what happened at Havens.
Yeah.
Right. We started selling it. We were like the only people that we knew that started selling it. We took soy off the menu. We still had almond. We started telling people, well, we have oat milk. They started using it. Then they got like completely connected to it. Then when the great oat milk shortage
yeah.
of 2018 happened,
yes.
people were literally offering my baristas $20, $50 for the boxes of oat milk that were in the fridge that we were like, so grateful to have. It was like liquid gold. People went bananas.
Yeah.
You could not have imagined that happening.
No.
But so, I mean, is that like a thing that you learn in business school? Like start with like one route to market and create something. And then is that like a thing or did you make that up?
They didn't have that class. If they did, I didn't take it. They didn't tell me to take that one. I took other ones that I are just
like I don't even know how that even,
so the things we were trying to solve for were
yeah.
like one, there's, you go to Expo East, you go to Expo West. There's so many brands out there with incredibly smart, passionate people that have great packaging, great products, but how does anyone ever know they exist?
Yeah.
And so what is the trial strategy for your brand? And you can hire good meaning agencies that want to put your product in people's hands and try it like that. But like creatively, maybe there's another way beyond paying someone to hand out a cup of oat milk in Grand Central Station when someone's like not in the, like
yeah.
quality contextual trial
right.
of your product is gold.
context being the big one.
Yes.
So like, because people put milk in their coffee,
yes.
start with
yes.
that.
Yes, because it allows people, because when I'm approached with like, if you're at a music festival and I'm there to enjoy that, like I don't right. want to eat a protein bar
no.
at a music festival.
No, you get your protein bar when you do your Ironman
sure.
and you get your CBD kombucha, matcha, whatever, when you're at some dancing thing.
Right. Whatever the
sauce?
Right, whatever the right quality.
Where do you get refrigerated sauce? Tell me, where do you get refrigerated sauce?
Yeah,
like,
I gotta think about.
Yeah,
that
okay. Word.
So that was one piece. You point out before, like it wasn't just launching a brand; it was building a category. So I needed
yeah.
to get a wet. And for us, like with coffee shops, we loved it when people would say we want Oatly in our coffee, but we are just as happy and still are just as happy when they say oat milk.
Honestly, I think it's synonymous for a lot of us.
And so I just want to build. You have to build category understanding and awareness. That was the second one. And I had a third. Oh, I think the third one is like, as, I don't know, as a founder, I'm not a founder, but like
right.
I, this US business is like deep in my heart.
Yeah.
Like there's so much ambition for all the things that we want to do, that we believe we can do.
Mm-hmm.
I could sit here and talk about all the different channels and products that we would aspire to, but at the beginning, to try to do one thing really well, and
yeah.
not everybody's able to do that, like financially, like, because what if we were wrong? Like, we would have had to recant
right.
the whole thing,
yeah.
And maybe I wouldn't be here today, like, if we were wrong on that. But from a small team, like, we had one product and one channel
yeah.
that we tried to really execute the crap out of,
and you did,
and we understood the mechanism, we understood the pricing, we understood the competitors, and we didn't try to do too much too soon. And then the market kind of told us when people were offering $20
yeah.
at Joe Coffee's and Haven Kitchens and places here in New York for like buying oat milk over the counter. We're like, okay,
crazy.
Cool. We should try to sell this in retail now, 'cause I think there's a market there for
right.
it.
Right. I mean, it's like, I'm looking at Maddie. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about innovation, because
sure.
you were saying, you know, because one of the things that we talk a lot about on this podcast is like, you know, unless you're just a super well-funded founder, maybe with like, you know, some experience and you get all this money, you can't open 500 Whole Foods stores day one, you know, and mostly because it takes a lot of learning. Like you have to figure out, I mean, we had a price change, we had a SKU change, we had a formula change, we changed our corrugated, we all within the first 6 months of launching.
Mm.
Had we done that in any, you know, in more than the 14 local New York City Whole Foods, I probably would not be here today, because
right.
I would have had a total nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Imagine doing that in 500 stores.
Yeah.
So we talk a lot on this podcast about like finding your core, you know, doing it really well, merchandising the hell out of that. Like if you're in five stores, be in those five stores every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like do it really well. If you have a great product and you put like really good energy into it and it's doing well, you will grow.
Yes.
It's not, you know, but, and it's a similar thing. Like find one channel
yeah.
and do it really, really
well. And even within that for us, like it wasn't all coffee shops. Like we
right.
believe that if we could find and identify coffee shops, and we hired people in our team that are not me. Like I'm not an expert in,
right.
I was never a barista. I never worked at one of these great specialty
right.
coffee chains. Like we imported that expertise into our team of really great,
right.
smart people that knew where the, like what places were setting the tone for the market.
Yeah.
And if you can nail those, we felt like it would open up the opportunities for them. So
right.
then it's like, oh my gosh, how do I do coffee shops in New York City? Well, we didn't have to do all of them.
Right.
We had to really like detail like some of them.
Right.
And if you that happens, the rest of it can kind of fall into place.
And it did.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. well, so two things. One is innovation, right?
Sure.
So you said 100 products in Sweden.
Yes.
And Europe, I guess.
Yeah.
So how do you know when to launch a new one? How do you know which one is the next one to launch? Do you create a whole different team of people? Like, how do you even go
yeah.
about the next thing? And I know that the next thing is ice cream.
Yeah.
Which is exciting.
It's delicious.
So how'd you choose to do that?
So there's a boring and an exciting answer to this.
Okay.
The boring one
I'm
is
gonna take the
partially
boring
like practically of like, there's ways, if we want to do the yogurts and we're really in love with the yogurts, there's like a mechanical processing thing that I can't find at co-packers that we would have to install in our factory that I just don't have yet.
Right.
And so ice cream, frozen, was frozen treats is a, I don't, there's,
yes, frozen treats.
There's probably someone from the dairy lobby I'm lurking sure. around.
I it. Doubt it. It's my podcast. The, I don't know that the dairy lobby oh, is never too know. Much.
I don't want to get, yeah. to get sued. Yeah. So like,
frozen treats,
frozen, yes. delicious treats. we could make that. Like we found, like we could do that without specialized equipment
States.
In the States,
right.
using our oat base that we have, we were able to like develop the flavors. And so, the first part was just practically, like, right. that would be the next one we could do.
Great, okay.
Secondly, we also thought of, like, okay, we have the oat milk, which is delicious and people like, and it's kind of like a core, like, staple everyday item. We thought then, like, it really does, like, a cool job of showing some brand stretch of what we want to be, what we want Oatly to embody of this, like, plant-based food and beverage company. Mm-hmm. To like be in something that's super fun. Like
yeah.
frozen is like a part of celebration yeah. and indulgence and like treat and reward. And like is a very different, I mean, you can get a reward from having a delicious like, you know, oat milk latte or matcha right. latte or something like that. But also like, it's just different from having like ice cream at like a birthday party.
Yeah, for sure.
And we thought that that was a space where...
And you're a fun brand too.
Yeah, it like, showcases it, things in like yeah. a very different way. The colors, the taste, the packaging. And so... And then ultimately, like we have a killer product development lead here in the U.S. who has been at Oatly for 10 years. He's moved over here with his family from Sweden
right.
to help us here in the U.S.
Did you have to change any of the flavors based on sort of like American palate versus yeah. European palate?
We did a couple changes. I mean, I generally think we take like 80 to 85% of what is successful in Sweden, and then we try to adapt it
right.
for the U.S. And so we adapted the packaging.
Right.
We felt like... they had things like vanilla, chocolate, strawberry. We knew we wanted to have those, but then we kind of kept going into like the classics.
Yeah.
We thought it was, in one sense, it was like, oh, we're just doing like the classics. But in the other hand, it's like really hard to do fully plant-based vegan
yeah.
frozen.
Especially with like the mix-ins.
It's, yeah. yeah. Like it, what I would do if I didn't have a great underlying like source ingredient, like if I couldn't control my oat base, then I would add in peanut butter and raspberry and
right.
birthday cake and
right.
all sorts of things, because you can make anything taste delicious yeah. with those. But to do like coffee
yeah.
and have it like mm. actually have like the mouthfeel, mm-hmm. the creaminess.
No toothsomeness.
It's not, it should not be yeah. toothsome at all. If you have those things feel. And like actually make it be credible, be like, oh, like I don't, there's no compromise here. The
yeah.
biggest barrier for plant-based consumption overall, whether it's burgers, oat milk, frozen, et cetera, is people are ready now to embrace those items.
Yeah.
But they're not, they can't perceive that it's a compromise
right.
to what they're, you'll get casual consumers who aren't just vegans or aren't, we want all those people too. We want vegans. We want
right.
people with dietary restrictions. But we also want like
just
my parents
yeah.
in Northeast Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
to buy that because they think it tastes great.
Yep.
And they're not perceiving a compromise to the ice cream that they used to order.
Yeah.
When brands have innovated to that level where
yeah.
you're able to do something like fully convenient, fully like plant-based with no compromise, then like the sky's the limit
yeah.
for how big the category can grow.
So going back to the great oat milk black market
yeah.
of 2018, I did hear that there were people on Amazon like mm-hmm. selling it.
Yeah. Amazon's like, the Wild West. It's like the world's largest.
I mean, some barista took boxes and sold it on. I mean, I don't even know how they got them, but
yeah.
More importantly, it goes to sort of the operations and the logistics. And it's, you know, we joke a little bit about like, yeah, it's a great problem to have. It's a super problem to have. But it's actually a super serious, stressful problem
yeah.
to have. I mean, and
it's definitely a problem.
Maybe less, well, I don't know, for small startups like mine, out of stocks signal to buyers that we don't have our shit together. And then, and they don't like that very much. So I'm wondering, A, how much damage control did you have to do? B, was it just like you just had no idea what was going to happen and the forecast just got blown away? C, how did you, I'm assuming you were still making it in Sweden and sending it over here. And
we were making it all over here.
You were making it here, and that was when the mm-hmm. shortage happened.
But we've made it here from the beginning.
Oh, from okay.
We've never imported from Sweden.
Okay. And so you just didn't have capacity.
Yeah. So I think the out of stock piece, like, it's why is it out of stock? Is it like Is it because they've been ordering six cases per week for the last 10, 20 weeks, and all of a sudden they're still ordering six, but you're not shipping them six?
Right.
That means you don't have your shit together.
Right.
If you're ordering, if they've been ordering six and now they're ordering 12,
right,
and then they're ordering 18, and you're like, yeah, we can get there, but like, I can't get you 18 tomorrow.
Right.
Like, then they're willing to work with you because like, why did that happen?
Right.
And I think with us, so we felt it was really important from the beginning to set up our operational footprint here in the United States. Importing from Sweden is both not going to be long-term financially viable. It's also not very sustainable to have to import all those things on big container ships.
Right.
So we set up what we, you know, a still to this day, like elements of that original operational infrastructure, which is all co-packers.
And that was part of your original job as the general manager.
Yeah.
Like when you came on board, you were supposed to create an entire marketing strategy and set up an entire production system.
I had a partner that was in charge of the contract manufacturing who
okay.
came from that world, but it's all ultimately on me.
Yeah.
All the pieces from forecasting
wow,
to
man.
Partners, quality, you know, everything, transportation.
Yeah.
Had to build a great team for that.
Oof.
But yeah, and we also have a unique product for us that I go back to the, I described how Dr. Oste
yeah.
developed the product. Like we have a specialized
you
manufacturing.
You had to teach the co-packer how to make it.
Yes, which is a delicate thing because if there's something that makes your product special and different,
yeah.
you have to be very thoughtful about how many potential partners you teach
right.
to do that relatively
oh
unique
my
thing
gosh,
within
of
your
course.
Category, right? And so that when we built the, it, I promise it, it wasn't that we were just like completely out to lunch with like, how, like, oh, we'll only sell two cases of this. Like, what a great, there, our investors, like, are, like, there's no way they would have let that fly. Like,
right.
we had a robust operational footprint, but what you're not ready for is when it's
right.
like, like
right, no, and I
hard.
Never really thought about it because like there is this proprietary piece. So it's not just like you can just turn on, you know, 15 co-packers
yes.
because you need to like jack up your production. A, you don't want that many people knowing it. You have to build some sort of trust around that
yes.
process and you don't want it out there.
It's one in food, like food and beverage, like one of the having things that are unique to your proposition, whether it's on an ingredient standpoint, a packaging standpoint, mm-hmm. I mean, a processing standpoint, like having being able to point to a meaningful point of difference there that shows up for the consumers is one of the hardest things you have to do. Like for Oatly, that is processing the oats. The rest of it, filling it into the packages is relatively, I mean, it's still a challenge like for us, and I can talk
mm-hmm.
about that for six more podcasts
right.
if you want to hear. But the key part is the oat-based processing. And we have a partner that still is with us to today. They are great. They worked with us. They went from making our product once a month to literally we were taking up 70% of their line
yeah.
every week, but it just wasn't enough
right.
because the demand was like a freight train running away.
Yep.
We decided as a company we'd build a factory to which we did in New Jersey, which
so now you make it yourself.
We make the oat base ourselves.
Right.
We're building a second factory in Utah. That's
wow.
like a lot of money and investment, but
and jobs.
And jobs and construction jobs. And we have 25 people in New Jersey. We're gonna have 50 people in Utah. That's amazing. But it doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
We have to have like investors that believe and they do.
Yeah.
But until then, what you tell the customers is, we're not adding new customers.
Right.
Like we, you know, we had like the way you do damage control to
yeah.
Whole Foods who,
yep.
or Wegmans or Target,
yep.
Our initial early customers, Fresh Direct is, and when we had this initial meeting, we said, boy, if you guys can do X number of cases, this would be a huge success. I'd be super excited. We're now doing two times that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're giving you as much as we can.
Right.
We're not adding new customers
yep.
and like taking your cases and giving them to them.
Yeah.
The company's investing tens of millions of dollars to build capacity behind
yep.
it. And you, it's one of the hardest pieces because your human instinct is to, you want to just tell, like you want to fix it.
Yeah.
Like you don't want them to be upset. You don't want to have the lost opportunity of
yep.
all these things. And like, you want to just tell them there'll be a date when it will be over.
Yeah.
And there isn't
you
a date.
You just don't
like
know.
That. And you just don't, on those ones, it's like, well, we're doing
but
our best.
You got it together pretty quickly.
We did.
Yeah.
I mean, that's great of you to say in retrospect. In the moment there, yeah. it didn't feel like it was happening no, particularly.
Because nothing does.
But then you also like can't waste that opportunity internally. Like we were basically fully capacity constrained. Our numbers were like flat for 4 months
right.
of just we're selling every case we can make.
Yep.
And then, but you have to then be ready that when it comes back, yep. like what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And the other piece there that was incredibly trying is, you're not like the market. It isn't just a static market where they're,
right.
everyone's just waiting on you. There's other people that are trying to
coming
do that
right
thing too.
There.
And,
yep.
you know, so you have to not squander that opportunity internally and externally to like make it something that we can build off of for the company. And right. I think we did an okay job at that. Like yeah. There's always things I would go back and try to do better, but we tried to make the most of it.
Okay. For the last 2 minutes.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Everything that you can tell founders that you wish that they could know. I mean, you know, there's a lot, right? So mistakes yep. that, you know, you've seen made along the way, things that you think really define great brands from okay brands, things that define great brands sure. from great businesses. What are like your...
So a couple things yeah. coming, some of them I've already said, but to reemphasize, yep. like I think you have to have a really thoughtful trial strategy for how is someone discovering your product exists.
Yep.
And if you can, I don't think enough, too many people in the natural food and beverage space do the like, and Whole Foods is an amazing partner, but do this kind of classic approach of thinking you like just because it worked for brand X is the way that right. I have to do that. Like you're not going to walk Oatly's path of where we were when we did it.
Right.
So thinking you, no one knows your product like you know your product, and thinking about how someone can try it in the best circumstance that will get make them be like, oh, like I need to have that in my mm-hmm. fridge in my life.
And it's not just like if I put it on the shelf, everyone's going to see it and be like, yay, because that is no. not how it
your
happens.
Kid. I mean. Yeah. Like, are you like, I mean, are you like that as a consumer? Walk into a grocery store. Like, do you see anything there?
Who knows?
Like, I walk down, right. I love shopping. I'm in CPG, but like, there's so much stuff that it's overwhelming. Yeah. There's more skew and it's not stopping.
No.
So trial okay. strategy, yep. like I think a creative, like that creative commercial, like channel strategy is really, really important. And I don't think enough founders put like thought into doing it in a different way mm-hmm. and like finding a different unique distributor, route to market, like price point, packaging solution, like something
yep.
that can give you like a foothold yep. to build upon.
Yep.
I think then, and this is a tough one, but like you have to build the company for the company you want to be, not the company that you are today. That's on a hiring standpoint
yeah.
of like, the minute you realize that you're like behind on this and people are like fraying at the seams, it's going to be another 3 to 4 months before you get that fixed. And that is sometimes a financial question. Sometimes it's a bandwidth question.
Right.
But the more that you can imagine what company you want to be in 4 months, be incredibly picky about the people you hire with both functional expertise and cultural relational expertise of mm-hmm. the company you want to be, the way you want to work, how they handle bad news, how
yeah.
they like respond to adversity. And if you can hire those people ahead of the business, it actually will enable, like people look at that as a cost rather than an investment. And I think people struggle with actually achieving or maintaining their growth because they're not thoughtful enough about hiring ahead.
Yeah, that's amazing. Speaking of hiring, did you find yourself hiring more people from the larger CPGs or from like people with more startup-y experience?
We have a handful. I mean, I have a handful of people that work at Oatly that I've worked with before that I kind of know that they're great at many things,
right.
but specifically the thing we want them to do here.
Right.
And we just know how they work. That's been phenomenal. I think that a big difference with a small company like ours or like startup sort of companies versus bigger companies is I can't pay for generalists.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, there's great smart people that say like, I'm in brand management.
You need
management.
Someone who knows like the sales calendar.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and if you don't know, I believe that you're smart and this is tough because I told this earlier about trying to get those interviews.
Yep.
Like, and like people yeah. not believing that the Navy nuclear engineer guy could do it. And like, but I wouldn't hire me
right.
for a job at Oatly today.
Right.
And yeah. so I think like I end up hiring people that have specific like skills that help me solve those problems that we need. And then as you grow, you can kind of fill in the cracks with people that yeah. are more on the strategy
awesome.
Side.
All right, Mike, we don't even have time for your best moment. I'm assuming that this interview is...
This would be definitely top three.
It's like the highlight of your week? Oatly experience. All right, because Matt's given me the old, like, you got to get off the horn now. Okay, Matt, thank you. Thank you for being the best engineer ever. Mike, thank you for coming on. Obviously, I have no words. So helpful, so amazing. And you're building this incredible thing, and we're all really happy that it exists. Thank you. Join us next time on In the Sauce. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.